Hello, I'm Kirsty Rice and welcome to Two Fat Expats. Now, this is usually the part where I talk about living a fat expat life and filling it up to the brim with fat ideas. But today's episode isn't quite like that. Today we're talking about when your big fat expat life falls apart, or more so when your expat marriage fails and you find yourself fighting to keep your children. We have two stories to tell today. Both are absolutely heart-wrenching. I think one thing to consider when you're listening today is that both of these women never expected to find themselves in this position. Both felt that they were lost and left without a voice as expat women with no legal rights. Separation and divorce is messy at the best of times, but when you're an expat far from home, it can be terrifying. So before we get started, I'm going to ask the lovely Nikki Moffat to come and join us from Hamburg, Germany. I, of course, am in Doha, Qatar this week. Hello, Nikki Moffat. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you, Kirsty Rice. How are you? I'd love to come and join you. It's warm in Qatar.
Today we're going to speak to two expat women who were happily married and both had children. Both women just had the one child and their marriage then broke up and they found themselves in a really awful situation that is very specific to an expat breakup. So I thought we'd start by talking to Jane. And I should probably say before we start that we've changed everybody's names. We're not mentioning the names of anyone's children, anyone's husband, but we're going to tell the stories. Jane and John met as expats, and they were both from different countries. I met both of them here in Qatar when they were no longer married. And when I met them, I was just blown away by how, inverted commas, good they were at being separated. You know, while they weren't together anymore, they had this amazing relationship where they managed to live in the same city, head off to their parent-teacher interviews together, have dinners, and it was very much shared parenting, you know, a weekend here, a weekend there. You'd often see them sort of side by side on the basketball court cheering. They both met new partners but still managed to stay friends. But it all started to get a bit more complicated when John got serious with his partner and wanted to start a new family. Jane was almost left as destitute when John started to scale back on the financial support. And I should mention both of them were working. It's just that John was the lead expat. So it was John's housing package. It was John's company package that they had. Jane had a job, but you know, she wasn't the lead expat. But John started to scale back on the financial support, and then he started to suggest that maybe they let the daughter come and live with him. And Jane was starting to get very nervous about where she was living and what her rights were within that country. So she left, went back to Europe with her daughter, and that was all fine until John came to Europe for the summer holiday to pick up the daughter, to take her back to for a holiday, except it wasn't a holiday. Turns out John had been talking to Jane's daughter privately, and she was obviously, she'd only been back in Europe, you know, for that year, and she was very homesick for Qatar and her old school, and he promised her that he could give her back her old life and that, you know, she'd be happy coming back with him. And Jane had no idea that any of these conversations were going on. So I began by talking to Jane about how strong her and John's relationship was at the beginning. And we'll just have a listen now, shall we?
Yeah, I mean, we were both fully supportive of our daughter. We went to school events together. At one time, I had a new partner, he did. We had dinners at home with our daughter together. You know, so on, for all intents and purposes, up until that time, I think we did a good job of breaking up, but still giving our daughter the best of both, if you like.
And so do you think it was a matter of once he'd met someone else and he was going to get serious with that other person that things became complicated?
Yes, I think so. Yeah, she became pregnant, and I think after that, he had new responsibilities, and where before, even though we were separate and he was with somebody else, I think me and his daughter were still the centre of his world, if you like. And I think once he'd got a new baby coming on the way, his focus changed. And financially, he withdrew support from me, which made it very difficult for me to continue to live in Qatar. At one time, I did have a discussion with him that I wanted to leave and I wanted to take with me. And basically, he said over my dead body, basically. Even though I'd gone there voluntarily, you know, and this sounds like sour grapes, but that he was the instigator of the breakup of the marriage. He left me. And I felt it was unfair that I had to live my life following what he wanted to do. So, for example, if he'd chosen to go work in another country, was I expected to go as well?
So the minute he sort of found another partner and set up with another family, you became almost like financially destitute. Is that fair
to say? Yes, absolutely. And I hated that thought. I'd always been a dependent woman all my life. I've worked until the time that I was in Qatar because, to rent a property there is extraordinarily expensive. And if you're not the lead earner where your house is provided for you, it's very difficult to earn enough money to continue to live there.
When your daughter went back for the holiday with him and then contacted you and said, I'm not coming back.
No, I found out in a completely different way.
How did you find out she wasn't coming back?
She left on the Saturday to travel back on her holidays, and the Friday she had a graduation at school to move up to the next year. And on the following Tuesday, I had a parent meeting with her teacher. And when I went in on the Tuesday, he presented to me a document signed by my ex-husband, which was an application for a school in Qatar. And that's how I found out. So both of them left without telling me, and neither of them actually told me. I found out through her teacher. I then had a meeting with the head teacher and blocked the application. That's how I found out. So I was absolutely devastated. He can offer her financially much more than I can, you know, so I think there was lots of promises made, and it did sour the relationship with my daughter for several months. She found it very difficult to speak to me, was very ashamed of what happened. It was an appalling time for me.
Yes.
She's my only child as well, and I had her later in life. And we separated when she was four, and, you know, she lived with me until she was 12. So, yeah, difficult time.
Now, when you guys were dating, and, you know, you're English, your ex-husband's Sri Lankan.
Yeah.
You met, I think, in Singapore, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
So it was a real expat love affair.
Yes, it was, but yeah.
And did it ever cross your mind, you know, if I have a family with this man, this is going to get really complicated? Or were you at that stage thinking, well, we'll both live in the UK and we'll be under UK law and it would all be safe?
I don't even think I thought that, Kirsty. I thought, I was 35 when I got married. I'd been a very career orientated. So I think once I decided I was getting married, for me, that was forever. So for me, I didn't consider that we'd just stay in the UK. There was a possibility of living in other places. But it never occurred to me that we'd actually break up. I don't know whether you don't go into marriage, do you, thinking of the consequences of a breakup? No, it never occurred to me that he would do what he's done. You know, I'd never think that he would think that she was better with him. I always thought he thought I was a good mother, and that as a daughter, as a teenage daughter, that she would be better off with me. It never occurred to me that he would do what he's done.
How have you got through this?
I think the first hurdle was letting go. That was the hardest hurdle. Obviously, as a mother, you want to fight for your child to be with you. And I tried lots of different avenues to do that, and lots of very long and angry conversations with my ex on the phone. And it was a sense that if I let her go, that I was a failure as a mother. Eventually, I had a chat with a friend of mine who's a psychologist and a counsellor, and she took me for coffee one day and said, the best thing that you could do is let her go. That if I fought to get her back and that she came back and was unhappy to be back, that that wouldn't be good for her either. So I think, in a way, she sort of gave me permission to let go and not be ashamed of backing down and stop challenging the situation. So in the end, that's what I did, because I didn't want to lose the relationship with my daughter. And so I think for me that was the biggest hurdle. And also, like you said, my relationship with my ex before had been wonderful. You know, we co-parented and it was fantastic. And then, you know, suddenly I didn't want any sort of relationship with him or any contact. But unfortunately, I have to because of my daughter. So it's sort of just really sucking it up and getting on and doing what's best for her. So I think for me, it's just trying to see her as often as I can, to speak to her as often as I can, be there when she needs me. And I just try and be there for her, really. I suppose I try and think what is best for her, not what is best for me.
I want you to think about, there's an expat woman out there somewhere now who's having all sorts of terrible, terrible dramas in her marriage, and she's got children, and she's in a country that's not her own, and she's feeling lost and scared about what to do. What advice would you give her to learn from your situation?
Gosh, I suppose, in hindsight, I wish I'd divorced with it written in that I was a prime carer. And I suppose unless you do that and have your legal boundaries set, everything else is difficult. That's the only advice I think I can give, because everything depends on the ex-husband and his attitude and how he is. Like I said before, for me as a parent, I want what's best for her. But some parents are always like that. So I think it is to get your legal standing set up if you're going through those difficulties.
And so do you think the best way to do that is to get back to your home country and try and do it from there?
I would say so, yes. I suppose it depends what country you're living in.
Yes.
You know, if we're talking about the Middle East or Asia, where the father has much more rights over the children than mothers, then yes, I'd get back to Europe or Australia or America, where women have equal or if not better rights to their children. I don't think in Qatar, for example, I don't think I'd have had any rights to keep her with me, because the male takes priority. But in your home country, you do have more rights.
Is it too harsh to say that your expat life lost you your child?
It's not harsh. That's how it is. Yeah. I think, you know, I could have grown up, I could have married the boy next door, got married, had children, and even if we'd broken up, the chances are we'd still be living in the same locale. So these issues don't arise, do they? They might live in a different city, it might be an hour away, but you still have weekends and different things. But if you're an expat living in different countries and, you know, like I said to you before, was I bound to follow him if he decided to go work in a different country? Would I have to give up my life again and go where he went? I don't know. It's a difficult one, yeah. But I think it is, as an expat or as... You know, because I had the combination of both. I had the expat and we were both from a different country to start with. You know, so it's a double whammy, really.
So, Nikki, what did you think?
Wow, just so many things I hadn't thought about myself as well. But one thing that struck me was the complexity of moving and being an expat. So one thing that Jane said was, you know, if he moved to a different country and was an expat there, was I expected to follow and just live there you know, like once your lives become separate, but you still have children, when you know that you're going to live in one country for a while, it's easier. But this whole up in the air situation, I mean, does anyone do that? Has anyone sort of separated and then followed their husband or their other partner around to other countries because of the children?
That's right. And this came up as an issue because he lost his job. And so they had moved, you know, they met in Singapore and then they'd moved to the UK and then they'd moved to Qatar. And then, you know, while this was all happening and he formed another relationship, he lost his job and he was looking for jobs elsewhere. And Jane was saying, am I meant to go with you? And he was saying yes.
Yeah, very difficult. And in some countries it might be almost impossible because if he has a new partner, that's his partner who he's going to sponsor on his visa. So how does the ex-wife even get into another country? I mean, you know, there are situations like that. But, I mean, that's one part of it. Obviously, the having to let go of her daughter is an incredible thing that, she, you know, she said she went through. So the first thought as a mother is to have your child to be with you, which is my first thought as well.
When Jane talked about how awful that time was, I think she was quite understated. I think really she almost, you know, in other conversations we've had, she's told me, you know, she feels like a breakdown when it all happened. And that was the only way that she could really continue breathing was just to let go. Like there was no other option.
Yeah, I totally agree. It must have been the most difficult thing. I understand it as a dispassionate third party outsider, but I can't imagine it as the person having to go through it.
So on that, we'll talk about Susan and Simon, who were both, they're both from Canada. They got married in their home country and they moved as newlyweds overseas to a foreign country. We're not going to say where for this one. I started by asking Susan if they had talked about or thought about what they would do if they split up while they were living overseas.
No, we didn't talk about that at all. I think like with most people, with most couples, especially early on in the relationship, we hadn't even lived together. We were just recently married and we moved together when we moved to it had only been 2 or 3 years into the relationship when we had the child. We didn't talk about that or think about that at all. I was always under the assumption that anything that had to do with our relationship or our children, like whether good or bad, we would defer to, you know, Canadian values, Canadian laws, things like that. I was under the, we didn't talk about it. I didn't know how, I thought he felt the same.
When the marriage did break up, how old was your child at the time?
He was 2 years old, just a little over two.
What were you initially thinking? Okay, well, this is how we'll have to play out.
I had looked up actually, in Canada, everything is quite clear. It's, if you and your husband have this much income, you've been married for X amount of years, this is what the support will be. This is what you're allowed as your finances, everything you own is cut in half. You get X amount support. You get this much visitation. There's 50-50 if you agree on it. So I was, when I left, I was in the impression that, okay, Canada, this is what I'll be getting. This is what I deserve. The child, I didn't want to take it away from him. I wanted a joint custody, which is a thing in Canada. I thought that, you know, I was worried about emotionally taking care of my child, emotionally taking care of me. And I was even worried about my ex-husband's emotions. That's where my concerns lie. I thought there's a whole series of laws and regulations out there in Canada that would take care of the rest, that I didn't have to worry about the rest, that I wouldn't have to fight for my property, fight for my child, fight for any little bit of things that I'd had accrued in this country.
And when was it that you realized that it wasn't going to pan out that way?
Well, we had been sharing visitation and custody of the child very well for quite a few months after the breakup and after I had moved out. We had been, it was always contentional and it was always, you know, hurt feelings and that, but he had never gave me access to my property, and he never gave me access to my bank account, and he never gave me anything in the way of anything financial. And every time we brought it up, he wouldn't talk about the subject. He would say, okay, when thinking about it, he wouldn't. So there was a little bit there that I thought maybe he's not thinking that he's going to honor the laws and the values that I had grown up with, that we'd both known from Canada, that maybe he was going to try something different. And then I had probably been living away from the marital home for, I want to say, 2 or 3 months when he did a complete 180, meaning that he He took the child. He threatened me with legal action. He threatened me with jail time. He said I couldn't see the child full stop and that he was going to fight for full custody. He was going to send me to jail if I didn't sign over all my parents' rights. That's when I knew that I had to get my divorce here because there was no way I could go home without my child. I wasn't able to see my child for months because just of the way he was behaving in the courts, and I was scared for myself because I know that's when I realized I'm in a different country and I don't have the protection. That's when I realized that I couldn't go home and that I had to deal with it in this country. And I wish, and if I could tell anyone anything, that if they're ever thinking about this, to go home, take your child and go home because it's been so difficult here. Security guards to the compound didn't allow me into the compound full stop after, even though I was still officially living, I was still officially his wife, that was still officially my home. He told the security guards I wasn't allowed in the compound. So it wasn't even a matter of me being afraid that the police would get me or me being, if I went there physically to get my child, to see my child, I wasn't allowed past the security. So it's another pile on it that, you know, people believe. And I don't want to say bad things about this country. I love this country. I want to stay here for another 10 years. If my son can stay in the school that he's in and we can all be here and be here happily employed. And, you know, if you're a man in this country, your word is twice as much as a female. And it's literally that. When we went to court and if he brought a male to testify, he had to bring either another male on my behalf or two females. My friends are all female. So I needed to find two of them to counteract every one male that he brought, which makes it, you know, difficult and frustrating for me and for my friends who are very, very good witnesses, very, very good character witnesses to me in court, knowing that whatever they were saying was the judge would only take half of what they said, take it at a 50% value as to what the men said. And that just goes back to, you know, him being able to tell the security guard that I wasn't allowed there because he's the man, and so it did make it so much more difficult. I felt when I was in court, I felt like when you're in those nightmares and you can't scream because you try to scream but your voice isn't making any sound. I felt like that every single day I went to court. I felt like I didn't have a voice. I didn't have representation. I felt that no one heard me. I still feel like that sometimes.
So after the court proceeding, what was their judgment? What did they rule?
My ex-husband had brought two of our mutual friends, male, to the court to testify about certain situations that they... parties that they had I'd been at, New Year's Eve parties, things that happened before I even had a child, just to give witness to my character that I'm a woman that drinks and that I'm a woman that's not responsible, even though I brought characters against, again, they were women. So because of these two witnesses, the court has ruled against me and I lost custody of my son. There's no such thing as joint custody. So it's either one person gets custody or the other one does. And there's no such thing as alimony. There's no such thing as division of assets. If you don't have custody of the child, you don't have anything. Now I'm fighting every day to take him on vacation. I'm not allowed to leave the country with him. And every time I apply, my ex-husband's lawyer brings up the fact that although it's been 4 years now that we've been divorced, more than that, since the testimony was valid, the stories that these character witnesses told were from 6-7 years ago. And it's been 6-7 years since these incidents still get brought up in court that no, she's lost custody because she's parties and she drank on New Year's Eve. And they have these men stood up in court and told us that. So I fight every time I can. I'm remarried, and I have a new set of in-laws who would love to see their grandson, who are good people, who live in America, and they're good people, and they're farmers, and they're church people, and they've got cousins and animals and just lots of love to give. And I'm fighting every day just to be able to take him out of the country because my husband won't let me, and the courts won't let me. So every time I get an email from my lawyer, it's just something that, you know, well, now we have to go and a letter from the school saying that you're a good mother. You've got to have proof of, you know, you're working. And they just, I am a good mother. I'm volunteer at the school. I go to classrooms and I talk about animals. I work a part-time job with animals. I put my son in taekwondo and in drum lessons. I'm part of the community theater. I'm not this person that they don't listen to. Like I said, I don't feel like I have a voice. I've never been able to tell my story to anyone.
Does he get to come and stay at your house? Or, you know, do you have weekends where you have him?
I have him during the week and his father has him on the weekends plus Sunday. And the only reason I have him for so much is because, the courts will legally, you're allowed to have one day, no matter what. And sometimes the courts will give you 2 days. The reason I have so many days more is because I went to the family consulting centers with my ex-husband, and I had a ton of letters of from people that wrote about how good a parent I am, how it would be an injustice to take away my son from me, that I'm a good influence in life, that a boy needs his mother. So I had all these letters, and I said, I fought, and it took hours and days of me talking to these people and talking with my ex-husband in the room, and him talking against me. But finally, I said I wouldn't relent. They'd have to have a court to tell me that I couldn't have these days. And eventually, we have an amicable agreement where I've got these extra days, which is good, except for because it's not court-ordered, he can take with my son away on vacation whenever he wants. He took him away for Christmas without me knowing. He just told me that he was leaving. He's going to be gone for 2 weeks, and that's 2 weeks of my time, you know, as well, not to mention that it was Christmas. So I didn't have a thing official, but I do have more time than I would if I was officially granted. So I'm happy for that. I'm happy to have him during the week. Important to me, and education is so important, so I love to be able to oversee that. You know, it's harder because he's, you know, tired from school and he's got homework, and we don't have, you know, the weekends. We don't have the birthday parties and the malls and the movies and the going to the park like we would if we had a whole weekend together. But whenever I can, I try to make the days special, but I also try to concentrate on school and getting good nutrition into him and making sure he gets enough sleep and just trying to be the best mom I can for the days that I have.
And what would happen if you were to drive to the airport now with him and attempt to leave the country?
I don't have his passport. So, and last time I petitioned for a vacation, it was for the Eid, and we went to Sri Lanka, and I petitioned successfully. Sometimes it's successful and sometimes it's not. I petitioned successfully for a vacation. My ex-husband wouldn't give me the passport until he was threatened with jail time 3 times before he handed the passport over to me. So I got it on the Thursday before the Friday we were scheduled to leave. It was a wonderful vacation, but when I went to the airport, I still had trouble getting my son passed because I don't have custody of him. I had the court order, I had the letter, I had, the passport, I had everything I needed, and I still was taken into the little room in the back, which was terrifying. And my son was sitting there with me, just excited to go on vacation, not understanding what was going on. I eventually did get to go, but it's going, I could never run away. There's no way. But this is a life sentence for me and my son, as long as we're in. I don't foresee me ever being able to appeal it. There's no, even in Canada, when you lose custody of your son, which only happens if you're a drug dealer or a prostitute, you lose custody of your son. You still can go back to the court in 6 months and say, look, I'm a better person, and plead your case again and again. Here, it seems like it's a life sentence. Fortunately, I've gotten remarried, and my husband is fantastic. And we're going to apply for custody again, and we're going to revisit the case again. But it'll be forever till I know for sure, till I'm safe. And I'll tell you, if I get custody, I will be fair. Like, this is all I've ever wanted, was just be fair and to share. They know he needs both of us, and to be able to give him the best. I don't feel that the courts have failed me. I might deserve what I've gotten, but they've certainly failed my son, to be able to not see his extended family, to not have enough time with his mother. And so I won't stop fighting. It's not for me. I fight to have him see his grandparents. I fight to have him be in my house where I know where he's getting good nutrition and enough sleep and taking care of his, you know, wearing clothes that fit him. So I'm fighting really for him. At first it was probably mostly for me, but now I can't stop, because if I stop, I can't give up. I can't let him know that I've ever just resigned myself to not being able to see him.
So, Nikki.
Yeah, wow. Just wow. I mean, just the pain and the heartache that you can hear in her voice when she talks about the things that she went through is just, it's gut-wrenching. I mean, it's very, very hard to listen to. And the fact that she thought that she and her husband would both just go along with the laws from Canada, because that's where they grew up, that's their cultural background. I mean, isn't that what we all think?
Yes.
I mean, yeah. Isn't that what you think? Yeah, I mean.
I agree. And Nikki, you bang on in that, you know, the whole time we're talking, you and I were talking about this earlier and saying about what if someone moves and goes to a different country, my logical brain says, well, my husband would never do that. He'd never say, I'm taking off to another country, or he would never say, I want to take our marriage through the local courts rather than what we've both grown up with, culturally understand and know. But you don't know that someone's not going to do that to you.
No, you don't. I mean, it's very, very difficult situations, and they just come about, you know, at the moment someone I know is going through a divorce, and 6 months ago or 3 months ago, they never would have said things they're saying now about their partner and about what things they would do and wouldn't do. So I just think that it's just very difficult to know what the other person's going to do.
Yes, absolutely. I'm not sure, Nikki, if we've sort of, because I know we haven't said where Susan is currently living, but I just want to make it clear, you know, that while we're not saying where she's living, that obviously she's in a country where she just doesn't have the same legal rights just for the mere fact that she is a woman.
Yes, and that's something that you don't necessarily think about. I mean, we always joke about not being a person, you know, I can't have my own bank account. I mean, and that's been in countries where I haven't ever looked into it, but I assume that I would have the same legal rights as a woman. You know, the whole court thing about her having to take two women for every man that testified, I mean, that's very confronting.
Yes. Now, Nikki, you forwarded me an article this morning about another expat couple with a really bizarre situation of their marriage breakup.
Yeah, very bizarre. And I saw it this week somehow, and it just struck me, I sent it to you this morning, because they're both Canadian citizens. They met in Toronto and married in 2002. A year later, they moved to Germany, where they had two children that were born. But by 2011, so 9 years later, they separated, and the interim custody was awarded to the father. And then in 2013, so 2 years later, the father signed over temporary custody to the mother in mutual agreement that she would take the children to Canada for schooling. So everybody thought that they would just go a temporary move for a year or so, and they left most of their belongings behind in Germany, and the mother and the children headed for Canada. Now, at the end of the following year, the father wanted the children to come back, and the mother refused, and so it went to court. Now, it first went to court in The Hague to see whether it fell under the international law regarding children and custody. And The Hague referred it to Ontario's court. So it went to Canada. So Canada alone decided the outcome of this case. And the outcome is mind-blowing to me. So 3 years on, the children, which were then aged 14 and 11, must return to their father's custody in Germany. The father has been ordered to provide housing for the children and for the mother. But they had to return to Germany. They're Canadian citizens. Their parents are Canadian citizens. Oh. It just blows my mind. So it was decided in the Canadian courts. And the other thing that I read in another article was that the children both said that they didn't want to return to Germany. And the court said that didn't really matter in this case.
I know. Gosh.
Just awful.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to make something clear, just going back, you know, because it's that whole thing about taking kids to another country is, you know, when Susan said that maybe she would have been sneaking and gone home with her child before the divorce, she made it very clear to me that only would have been to get a Canadian divorce with joint custody, and then she would have come back and shared raising her child with her ex. And she made it very clear that she would never take a child away from a parent, you know, unless there was some sort of terrible situation, like an abuse situation or something. She never ever wanted to do anything illegal. All she ever wanted was just justice under sort of Canadian laws and values. So, yeah, it is fascinating, isn't it, that a Canadian court could send a mother and two kids who have stated that they do not want to go back to Germany, that they could do that.
Yeah, and we'll put the link in so people can have a look at it, to that particular article.
Yeah.
And as we said, that's also been in the news again this week, because an Australian celebrity has talked about her own situation.
So Melissa George is really quite well known in Australia because she was in one of those Australian, you know, television series, Home and Away. But she went on and she was actually Ross and Rachel's nanny on Friends, which I never saw. Yes. But she was,
oh, yes, I think I know that. She's also in Grey's Anatomy, though.
Yes, yes. And she was in a show called Lie to Me. But the one thing I really liked her in was in Treatment, which had Gabrielle Byrne, and he was a psychiatrist and or psychologist, you know, and he would go and have these one-on-ones. It was a really good series.
Yes, it was a good series. It was very intense because every scene was just two people, right?
Yes, yes.
Just in his office, yeah.
Yes, but Melissa George went on and she married a Frenchman, and Australia had that whole tall poppy thing where they got cross with her because she said she'd prefer to be in France eating croissants or in New York rather than being in Australia having everyone ask her about being on Home and Away, which was, you know, a million years ago, which I kind of understand. But anyway, she has had this terrible week where there's been a severe breakdown in the marriage. She's allegedly been assaulted. She wants to go back to Australia and she can't because she cannot leave the country without her husband's permission. And
because she has a child.
Yes, yeah. And I think they even have two. So it just goes to show it doesn't even matter how much money you've got or the best lawyers. When you're away from home and these things happen, you are going to be in a huge pickle. Now,
that's right.
Our other what in the world this week, because, you know, we like to do a little 5-minute segment on what's happening in the world for expats. And we cannot
talk about
this because this was a big week. So, you know, a couple of days ago there was an article out about they are now not going to let us have any electronic devices travelling into the US. And is it into the UK as well, Nikki?
Okay, so the rule is, as far as I understand, into the US it's from 8 countries and destinations and into the UK it's from 6. So if you're in Doha and you're flying to London, you can take your laptop with you on the plane. If you're in Doha and you're flying to the US, you cannot.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's just not confusing enough. But anyway, there it is.
So this has caused huge, huge discussions on expat Facebook pages all over the
everywhere.
World. Everywhere. And it comes from the outrage of how will my 2-year-old be able to watch Peppa Pig on the iPad if you steal it from me? Or how will I travel with anyone under the age of 5 without an iPad?
To be honest, we started traveling with kids before there was individual seatback TVs.
Yes.
The planes have come a long way, baby.
And if people are looking for tips and ideas, we will provide a link. Someone put a fantastic post in the Fabulous Expat Women group. We do have a little group called Fabulous Expat Women. If you are a fabulous expat woman, come and have a look for us on Facebook. But someone had, I think it was Tammy Needler, had put in a great folder full of activities and ideas of things to do for travelling with children. The thing for me is the safety issue of losing my laptop.
Yeah, I couldn't do it. I've been struggling. I've been checking because, as you know, I'm flying to Dubai, and I've been checking that the European airlines and it's not going to start impacting Europe as well, mainland Europe, because I'm like, I can't go to Dubai without my laptop, but I can't go if I can't take my laptop.
Oh, I can't imagine.
But Kirstie, as you pointed out, there is a company that's about to make a killing.
Yes, yes. So someone put this incredible link to a great product, which is like a pouch that has a lock on it, and the pouch is big enough to fit your laptop in it, so obviously big enough for your camera or your iPad and everything else. But it's a pouch with a lock on it, and it has one of those almost like a bike lock, you know, that sort of coating, that cord on it, where you could link it inside your suitcase. So if someone's going to have to go to amazing effort to lift your laptop out of there, like they'd have to cut through the cords, which would be near impossible. Or,
Blaine, to me, it's not just about having to put your laptop in the luggage, it's about the weight allowance.
Yeah,
you're gonna like miss out on 2 kilos of clothes
or two kilos
or
of
shoes.
Vegemite.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, Nikki, we're talking about podcasts, social media, telly, and what you've been watching. What have you been doing this week? What have you found?
I said last week I was going to listen to a podcast of someone who'd written us a review last week, and their podcast is called Workationing. And I had to think about that before I said it because I keep meaning to think it's called Worktationing because I think that sounds better. But anyway, I'm sure they're not going to change the name now. There are two ladies in their mid to late 27s, apparently. And I'm not sure if that's true. She seems, one of them seems to have a slip up early on that mentions an age starting with a 3, but I can't be sure. Anyway, Carrie and Kelly have packed up their life and their business, and they're moving. They're aiming for a year to be digital nomads. So they're doing 1 month per location. One of them owns a business and one of them works for the same business. But the business owner has, I think, 12 employees in the US. So they're basically having a holiday a month, but they're working the whole time, working full time. So the first couple of episodes you can probably skip if you're not in your mid to late 27s, which I am not anymore. It made me feel a little bit old. It was a lot of moping about how hard it is to pack up their lives and how much there is to do. And I was like, dude. We do that all the time. And one of them had to break up with a boyfriend to go on the trip, and there was a lot of lying around in hotel rooms drinking. And I did listen to it all. And Carrie and Kelly, I'm sorry, but I would recommend to our listeners to maybe skip the first couple of episodes.
Right.
But then after that, it definitely picks up. It's about living a digital nomad life, and it's about the problems they come up against. And they come up against, you know, a lot of problems we come up against.
Yeah.
Internet. They're running a business or working a full-time business. She runs some sort of media business, and one of the girls had to live tweet a show. And it was only when they arrived in another country they realized that they don't have the same cable TV that they have in the US.
Oh.
And Netflix doesn't show things live. So they had to make a solution on how to live tweet a show. So there are some interesting things like that. One thing they do, a really good recommendation they came up with, is to find a fixer. So when you get to a place, you need to find a fixer. So someone who can navigate locally for you, yes. Grifting and fixing.
Yeah.
And I think that's perfect for all expat life.
A lot of expat men that do that. And they call them wives.
That is so true. I'll just tell Carrie and Kelly they should be married and find a wife.
Yeah.
Did enjoy it. It did take me a few episodes to get into it, but it's certainly, perhaps I'm just too old. I don't know. But
is it kind of like when you first start watching Girls? I remember watching the first couple of episodes of Girls and thinking, oh man, you know, this is so self-indulgent, because it's not. It's just that once you obviously have kids, such a cliche, but you start to be completely focused on, you know, one other person's lives, and then for you, Nikki, it's two, and for me, it's four. And you're navigating, and then you stop having those conversations about yourself.
I think that might be it, but I'm enjoying it. They went first to Puerto Rico, which, it's kind of like the 51st state. But now they've really branched out. They've gone to Colombia. And they're in Colombia right now. They've come up with some good ideas, so things they want to do in each location, so they don't just get there and then just blow their time or blow their plans.
Yes.
It's worthwhile having a listen, and then you can make up your own mind.
Yes. And obviously I was being unfair when I said about expat men needing wives as fixers, because we all know that it is a world of equality now, and there are plenty of women that use their men as fixers and their expat husbands as fixers. But
that's right.
We're looking forward to an ideal world when both expats travel together and can employ a fixer to help them both.
Correct. Okay, what about you, Kirsty? What about your podcast?
So I had a little bit of a revelation this week when I was listening to a podcast. We are obviously big fans of Chats 10 Looks 3, and
So big fans.
I love them. I'm still getting over. I haven't told that story to everybody yet.
I don't
even know if I want to tell that story, but now I have to, don't I? Because I've said that out loud. So, dear listeners, you know that I have been madly, you know, fangirling Annabelle Crabb for years. You know, I read everything she's written within moments of her pushing the publish button. I've read her books, and then you can imagine my joy when I went to a party and there she was. The only unfortunate thing about that was before I'd got to the party, I'd been to two other parties, and I had very well partied, and I was maybe not as fluent as I would hope to be, or as clear as my
verbal
thoughts.
Sparring.
Yes, my verbal skills were not on point. And I did get very excited about seeing her. But, you know, sometimes you can meet your people that you love and you get so excited that you're trying to play it really cool.
Cool were you?
Oh, I die. Every time I think about standing out on that balcony talking to her, I die a little bit more. So, yes, I was very, very lucky to meet Annabelle Crabb, but I probably didn't feel the conversation with things that I would have liked to.
Witticism, intelligent witticism.
There was no intelligent witticism. There was just drunken rambling. Anyway, but back to the point. So I'm listening to Chats 10 Looks 3 and Lee and Annabelle were talking about how Annabelle had been on a show called Home Delivery, which is on the ABC. A woman called Julie Zamari goes back with all sorts of people, musicians, politicians, just well-known Australians, and she goes back to their home where they grew up and sort of walks through what their life looked like, where they grew up, where they went to school, what they filled their time with. And Annabelle was recently on the show. Lee was on the show a couple of years ago. And Lee raised a point that she had ran into one of the producers of the show, and the producer had said out of everybody that they'd gone back to visit, like where they'd taken them back to their hometown and their first house, that Annabelle Crabb was the very first person where her parents still lived in the house and she could go back and show you, you know, this is how we lived, this is my room, you know, this is what it was, because
this was the pencil marks on the wall about how tall we were.
Yes, yes. And that everybody else, their parents had moved on. Do you know, they'd sold the place, gone on to a different life, things had moved on, life had gone on. And I just thought that was something very, very important for expats to think about and realise, because I think often as expats we feel that we leave our homes and that we can't share these things with our children and show our stories. But it happens to everybody. Everybody becomes homeless in their own time. And, you know, I was talking to my mum about it and she said, yeah, she said, you know, the house I grew up in, very soon after we left, it got demolished. It doesn't exist anymore. There's nothing there. She said, I've never been able to take you back and show you, you know, what it was like, or for you to get a picture in your mind. So I think I just thought that was quite interesting. Also, I had another podcast that I was listening to by 2SER, which is a radio station in New South Wales, and it's called Just Words, and it's true stories from those who have used the Racial Discrimination Act and those who've had it used against them. It's one of those podcasts that is beautifully produced, Nikki. Like,
oh, I have to listen to it immediately because I love a beautifully produced podcast.
You do. And you and I both have that same longing for one day we will have that.
Yeah. When we grow up. Yeah. When we're grown up podcasters.
But this one, the first episode looks at Holocaust deniers and survivors. And I find that quite interesting. My children have actually met quite a few Holocaust deniers in their time, which I find
really
fascinating. And I know in my travels I have met some Holocaust deniers, and, you know, I don't know, Nikki, have you ever met deniers of 9/11, people that don't believe the
planes? Yes.
So the story begins with a woman called Francine who's telling her story about being a young Jewish girl in Belgium. So she was about 4 in 1942, and she talks about being sent to a farm to hide and then how the soldiers came and she was hiding in a haystack, which soldiers then prodded with a pitchfork. And she still has the scars in her neck. She wasn't caught because she laid so quietly while it happened. Ugh. It's just, yeah, incredible stories. But it's all about, because in Australia at the moment there's a huge discussion about the 18C Discrimination Act and changing the wording of the Discrimination Act and about free speech. And it's just a great discussion, and I think it's well worth going to listen to.
Excellent. Good to know.
What about you? What else have you got going
on? Social media. I didn't do a lot of TV this week, but social media. So this week in our Facebook live chat on Monday, we talked about podcasts and how long our listeners think our podcast should be and what they like about it and what they like to see included, etc. So, and you and I talk about that a lot because we have slightly different opinions. So there was an article on social media this week called "I Listen to a Lot of Podcasts and Here's What I Found." And it was written by a guy called James Cridlin as a result of a podcasting judging competition that he did. But he's a radio futurologist. So he's a consultant on the effect of new technology platforms that having on radio across the world. The article had three main tips for podcasters. So the length should be 30 minutes because that's the average commute time. That's a good length that he said. He said too long means this. One, you don't care about your listeners. Two, you don't know how to edit, which makes you stupid. Or three, you don't want people to listen to it, which means you're also stupid. So he was very harsh. And the second thing he said was that resetting. So you get new listeners every day or every time your podcast launches. So your job is to make them feel welcome, be interesting, and have a reason for people to want to listen. And the third thing he said he saw a lot of was self-indulgence. Too much banter, too many in-jokes, and a loss of focus. Kirsty. Anyway, so this article was shared on a group called She Podcasts, which is a group of 5,000 women podcasters, mostly all over the world, but mostly based in the US. And they are not happy. They are not happy to write about this article. So I just thought it was a very interesting article. I'll put the link up. But I just thought it was interesting to note that this is something that we're talking about all the time, you and I, behind the scenes. Founder of the She Podcast Group said she doesn't want to be called stupid and she doesn't think she's stupid. And just to spite him, she wants to go out and do a two-hour interview and post it on a podcast.
Oh, look, I tend to agree with him. I think 30 minutes is perfect. And I think that would be great. 30 minutes is about right. But I also see that, like you think about today's podcast, we interviewed two amazing women. Both of those interviews took about 20 to 25 minutes. And when it came to editing them, you know, you and I had a conversation of we didn't want to. One of them, I think we got down to 13 and one was to 12 because it's so hard. And I know that if we were really clever and really slick, we would actually have little sentences that the women said and then we would come over and talk and then we'd have more sentences and come over and talk. But that's not the way we do the podcast. I can't see how we could ever, not without new technology being invented, do you know, for us to do it remotely in different places.
Yeah, but also it's not the way we do things. We're trying to share a whole story. And I think that our listeners, as they said in the Facebook Live feed this week, they enjoy the interviews. They enjoy listening to all the parts of the story. So sometimes, sure, it's not honed in exactly on the exact topic, but, you know, no one's life is just about one thing. You know, your life is about more than one thing. So hearing people talk about more than one thing is also important.
Then addressing that other issue about the self-indulgence, I am so bad at that. I know I'm really bad at that. I quite often go, oh, God, Kirsty, shut up. But then with the stories about, you know, like I just told you the story about Annabelle Crabb, is that something do I cut out the story of me standing on the balcony talking to Annabelle Crabb, or is that something that people would find quite interesting? Oh, Kirsty met Annabelle Crabb at a party. I don't know.
Well, as a former listener, I would have found it interesting, but now I can't tell you because I hate listening to the sound of my own voice, but I'm so bad at editing. As you know, you say you need to make that 10 minutes shorter and I never do. I'm like, I made it 5 minutes shorter. What have you got? What have you been looking
at? For me on social media, there were a couple of things that I loved. Have you seen the little clip about the magnifier on your iPhone?
I have not. I'm missing out.
Okay, so there's a fantastic clip making the rounds at the moment, and there's a woman who's probably in her 50s sitting at the kitchen table with a pair of glasses on, and her friend is videoing her, and her friend says, pick up your iPhone. Okay, go to settings, go to whatever, it'll walk you through on the page, but basically what it shows you, I had no idea. Your iPhone has a magnifier on it. Did you know that?
I didn't know that because I don't have an iPhone.
Oh, you don't? Okay. Okay, well, I didn't know this, but on your iPhone, you can go into settings and you can push magnify and you put it in front of the newspaper or whatever you're reading and boom, it makes it bigger. And you can choose to make it bigger, bigger, bigger or smaller, smaller, smaller. And this woman was saying to her, you know, what do you do when you go to a restaurant and the lights are dim and you're trying to read? Well, this is what you do. You pull out your iPhone, you push magnify.
With your torch.
And it does it. It magnifies it. Anyway, this woman makes this great phrase where she says, wow, this is better than sex for a woman in her 50s. So I'll put a link to that so other people can see.
Got something you want to talk about for reading?
Yeah. Look, I read this. It's a long form, so it's going to take you a little bit to read. I read a piece in The Guardian this week, and it was called London Bridge, but it's basically about what will happen when Queen Elizabeth dies. And when I say what will happen, it's not just sort of about the psychological effect on a country. It is actually about what will actually happen in the media, like what they have planned and what will play out. It's been 65 years since the last British monarch died.
Yeah, there's been a lot of changes since then in the world.
Yes, huge changes. And so they talked about how the deputy editor of The Guardian has a list of prepared stories that are pinned to his wall, that the Times is said to have 11 days of coverage ready to go, that Sky News and ITN for years have sort of rehearsed the death of the Queen, substituting with the name Mrs. Robinson. There were some things that were really quite uncomfortable to read where obviously they have to practice these things. Like, we all know that obituaries are already written out for newspapers, you know, that people get those things ready. But they had, for years, people would come into work sort of writing stories about the Queen Mother choking on a fishbone, you know, to sort of get them prepared for writing those stories of what might happen. But they did have a scenario about Princess Diana dying in a car crash on the M4.
Yeah. And I did actually read this article as well. It was fascinating.
Oh, you did?
Well, yeah. I did read it, but I'm just, I didn't know what you were going to say. So now I know what you're saying. But it just made me compare to when I was living in South Africa. Nelson Mandela was reported having passed away when he had not. He was in hospital. And yes, it said the local media in South Africa and the international media are quite crazy. And I remember being on Twitter at the time going, people, it's not dead. And because it was really crazy. And in the end, I had moved to the US by the time he unfortunately passed away, but made me realize, like, someone of such immense global significance and what happens around that. So yeah, that was kind of what it made me think about.
Yes, I had a girlfriend who was a foreign correspondent at the time, and I remember the back and forth of, is Nelson going to die this week or is he going to die
and
next
people
week?
Flew into the country. I mean, there was this massive influx of this media with all their plans, and they wrote then about all the plans they had for when he was going to pass away. So that was, I was kind of comparing it to that.
Yeah.
But just the whole fact that the book, so for years and years and years, there's a book of, you know, like everything. When you do a project, you write your lessons learned and you put it away and get it out next time. But in this case, there's 65 years since Queen Elizabeth's father passed away. So the book that they had of all the steps that they take and what they do, I mean, that's basically redundant.
Yes, yes. All right. Well, Nikki, I think that's us done for this week. So just a reminder, everybody, if you're still there and you haven't left us 30 minutes ago, please, this is the bit where we plead for a recommendation or a review on iTunes, because it does help keep us in the charts, which is the only way that people can find us, is if they see us up there and available to see. So if you've got a minute, we would love it if you hopped across to iTunes and left us a rating or a review.
Yes, we'd love you to leave us a review. Also, next week, what we want to do is we want to find as many adult third culture kids or TCKs as we can. So if you know a TCK, or if you are a TCK and you're now an adult after your early 20s, I don't know if we have any listeners in their early 20s. and beyond. We want to hear from you. All we want is like a 1 to 2 minutes about your life as a TCK, how you think it impacted you. Do you think it's had an impact on how you're living your life now? And what about for your children? Do you want them to be TCKs or not?
So would a good example be if I jumped on the twofatexpats.com page and I pushed the microphone button and I said, hi, Nikki. Hi, Kirsty. Which would be weird because then I'd say, I'm Kirsty from Doha and I was a TCK and I really hated it, or I really loved it and it made me decide to plant roots and never go anywhere, or it made me decide I wanted to be an expat, or I went on to have kids who were TCKs, or I didn't have kids that were TCKs. So is that sort of what you're looking for?
That is absolutely what we're looking for. And if we'd love you to go on the website and do that, and then we'd like to put as many as we can in next week's episode. If you can't go on the website, you can send us a message through our Facebook page or an email to twofatexpats@gmail.com, and I can set you up with a 1 minute Skype recording as well.
Fantastic. Okay, well, Nikki, I will talk to you next Monday on Facebook Live.
Facebook Live. See you then. Don't be late.
Bye.
Bye.